respect to the question of gay marriage. Lynn and I have a gay daughter. So it's an issue that our family is very familiar with. We have two daughters, and we have enormous pride in both of them. They're both fine young women. They do a superb job, frankly, of supporting us, and we're blessed with both our daughters. With respect to the question of relationships, my general view is that freedom means freedom for everyone. People ought to be free to enter into any kind of relationship they want to.
Now, that, of course, was Vice President Dick Cheney last week in response to a question that was posed to him when he was speaking about gay marriage, explaining that he has a daughter who is a lesbian, and saying what he said a number of times about gay marriage. We're going to talk about those remarks on the part of the Vice President last week on freedom and homosexuality. How does that freedom argument hold up when he says, look, we live in a free country, and freedom means that everyone should be free to establish whatever kind of relationship they see fit, up to and including gay marriage? He says that's left up to the states. We're going to be talking about that with Dr. Christopher Wolf here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Feel free to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's the 30th of August. We're coming to you live this Monday, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the second half hour, we're going to talk with Mike Pierce about the hostility of the world, it seems, or big parts of the world, toward Western civilization. He has written a book called Why the Rest Hates the West. We're going to talk about, well, the underlying assumptions in Western civilization and why they run contrary to how people in the rest of the world think. That's the second half hour of Issues, Etc. Then, in the second hour of the program, we'll start out talking with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. We'll get a live report from New York, where the Republican National Party is meeting in its convention to nominate later this week President George W. Bush as their candidate for president. Of course, the story about the protesters, we'll get some of that from Congressman John Shimkus as well. Also, your thoughts and your comments on what you've seen so far, just today, and of the protests leading up to the Republican National Convention in New York. Then, in the last hour, we're going to be listening to Juanita Bynum. This is part of our ongoing series, occasionally here on Issues, Etc., where we hear popular television preachers. Juanita Bynum, you might have seen her billboards, 6 months ago, maybe last year, she came through with her Weapons of Power tour. She's doing a series on her television program on Christian prayer and the Lord's Prayer. And we're going to be listening to her message as much as we can get in, and just applying the simple diagnostic tool that we do when we do this. Is Jesus mentioned? We're trying to figure out whether we're listening to a Christian message. Is Jesus mentioned? Is Jesus the subject of the verbs? And if so, what verbs is Jesus the subject of? What is the preacher telling us that Jesus has done and is doing for us? Is the cross mentioned? Is sin mentioned? Is God's grace rightly defined as his favorable disposition toward sinners for Christ's sake? Not in those words, but is it rightly defined? We'll talk about that in the third hour of Issues, Etc., and we invite your questions and your comments, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Christopher Wolf is a regular guest here on the program. He's professor of political science at Marquette University, president of the American Public Philosophy Institute, and editor of the book Same Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality. Dr. Wolf, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Before we begin to talk about the vice president's comments there, I just wanted to give you thanks because I've recently completed writing a pamphlet on same-sex marriage, and your two volumes that you have edited there on the issue were very helpful to me in composing that particular piece. Thank you very much.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, basically, that was an important part of the reason for having the two books, to try to get information out there to help other people articulate a sound position on those issues.
Your reaction to Vice President Cheney's comments last week on when asked about gay marriage?
Well, obviously, we all sympathize, I suppose, with parents who have to confront the very difficult question of how to handle having a child who's homosexual. And I think this is, you know, one of those unfortunate circumstances where a parent you know, perhaps out of a great deal of love for their kids, which is a great thing, has really that influenced their understanding of principle. And I think it's unfortunate, very unfortunate, that Cheney came out the way he did. I don't think his position is really sustainable if you think about it. You know, freedom, he says, is freedom for everyone. Well, does this mean that we have to allow people who want polygamy to have polygamy? That if fathers want to marry their adult daughters, you know, they should have a right because freedom means freedom for everyone? You know, freedom is freedom and not license. And there are certain limits on all the freedoms that we have. And I think Americans in general still think that there are important limits on the freedom to marry, that we're not free to marry anybody that we want to marry, that there are some limits that flow from the very nature of marriage as an institution.
Now, the vice president made that freedom argument, and you responded there. And then he says, you know, with respect to the, he went on to say, in fact, with respect to the particular question of same-sex marriage, that should be left for the states to decide. Is that any kind of safeguard against same-sex marriage, or as you have said, by that freedom argument, polygamy or polyamory or anything else that would people might want to enter into as a relationship?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, having some limitations on marriage in the states can do some good, but I think it's pretty limited, and especially in the long run, I don't think it's likely to be very substantial. It's true that Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act in the 1990s, and according to that, no state has to recognize a marriage from another state that is not between one man and one woman. But to tell you the truth, it doesn't take much of a look at the courts to realize that once they are convinced that they can get away with it, they're very likely to discover a right to gay marriage in the document. And there's a reasonably decent chance that in the long run, at least the Defense of Marriage Act will be struck down. So the fact of the matter, I think, is that this is one of those kinds of issues, abortion is another, that really reminds us of Lincoln's argument back in the mid-19th century that this nation cannot long endure half slave and half free. There are certain very fundamental issues of principle that can't simply be compromised and allowed to be variable from state to state. You know, one side or the other is going to win out eventually. And certainly when you think especially that the media, the entertainment industry, that intellectuals in general in this country are engaged in a very sustained campaign to validate gay marriage, it seems to me that if you don't have a constitutional amendment defining marriage as between one man and one woman, a federal constitutional amendment, then the chances are awfully good, very, very likely, that in the long run, courts will simply shove gay marriage down our throats.
Vice President Cheney articulated that argument of freedom, and that is the argument that is also employed by those who are advocating for same-sex marriage and the widespread acceptance of homosexuality in general in our society. You've made the case it's not really a matter of freedom. Then why should it be a matter of public concern?
Well, the key thing is the situation with the family. The family is an institution that, in a fundamental sense, predates society. And society is not free to simply manipulate the family whatever way it wants to. It's really based on the family and has to recognize its essential features. It doesn't take much to see that in our society for the last 40 years, the family has come under really significant attack, and that the stability of the family has dramatically weakened. And it's also fairly easy to see that weakening of the family is correlated with a lot of the social problems or pathologies that we have. It includes things like, you know, poverty, crime, low academic achievement, further divorce in the family, and so forth. And unfortunately, heterosexuals having paved the way by breaking down families and marriage through especially no-fault divorce, are now simply extending those principles to the point where it permits homosexual activity as well. That's simply, in a way, another nail in the coffin of the traditional stable family unit where you had a man or woman married to each other for life and raising the kids they'd engendered. And unfortunately, the whole question of the family today is really in flux. I mean, even a lot of people who have fairly sound instincts are really not as clear on the foundational principles of the family as they need to be. And that's one reason why the campaign for gay marriage is making headway slowly but surely. If, you know, for instance, kids go to their parents and try to get some sense from them of what family is, and their parents say, well, no gay marriage, but no-fault divorce, you know, cohabitation before marriage, things of that sort, well, those aren't so bad, then they're really getting a mixed message, which I think fundamentally undermines the family in the long run. And the kids draw the logical conclusion, well, if marriage is something that can be simply for, you know, personal intimacy, and if it could just be this kind of, you know, series of different relationships over time, then why should homosexual marriage be excluded? And, you know, given that logic, it's easy to see how they reach that conclusion.
We're talking with Dr. Christopher Wolf, professor of political science at Marquette University, president of the American Public Philosophy Institute, and editor of the book Same-Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality. Dr. Wolf, we spoke recently with Greg Kokol, and he draws this kind of connection. I hear it in your responses as well, that if the sexes are considered interchangeable, then of necessity, parenting will be redefined as we see fit, family will be redefined as we see fit, and in the end, the family will be deemed to be a product of culture, and rather than the other way around, culture the product of the family.
Well, we already see that. I mean, if you look at most intellectuals' analysis of the family, what they constantly emphasize is not that there's a family, but there are families, different kinds of families, and that there really is hardly any core to marriage that's unchangeable. Now, it's certainly true that there are important historical variations of families, you know, some, you know, better, some worse, and nobody argues that there's just been one form until today, and all of a sudden today there are new forms. Having said that, the real question is, what is the core of family? And there, I think, historically, the answer is kids, that really family exists in order to bring children into the world and to give them the best set of circumstances in which to be raised. I think that the area where that's been most attacked, really head-on, is in no-fault divorce. The idea that even in families with children, one spouse can unilaterally declare that the marriage is ended, and that the interest of the kids in living with a mother and father together doesn't outweigh that kind of individual license, spells the end of a really stable and solid family institution. And to bite the bullet, I mean, we've talked about this before, and this is something that not all of your readers or listeners are going to agree with, but I really do think that one of the key events in this transformation was the adoption of contraception by a lot of married couples even. You know, once contraception became widely used throughout American society, especially in the 1960s with the advent of the pill, what was bound to happen was a fundamental disjunction or separation of marriage and family on one hand and children, and on the other hand, sex. And if you look at our society now, that the tie between them is pretty tenuous. I mean, one way I like to raise the question is to ask, take your average 18-year-old in this society and think of all the different sexual images that he or she has been presented with in the first 18 years of life, and ask, how many of those images of sex had anything to do with children. And I think the answer is pretty clear that, you know, the overwhelming presentation of sex in our culture nowadays is that it's about pleasure and personal intimacy, and the vast majority of sex has just nothing to do with kids whatsoever. I don't think that that could have happened without the fundamental separation of sex, marriage, family, and children. And the, I think the key battering ram in that was the development of contraception.
Now, an argument put forth by some of the advocates for same-sex marriage is that if homosexuals in the United States were allowed the benefit of marriage, that it would reduce the rates of depression and suicide, of promiscuity and disease among homosexualities, and that would be an obvious social good. Therefore, we ought to legitimate same-sex marriage. Your response?
Well, I mean, that's an assertion that that will happen, but frankly, the evidence for it is not all that great. The argument is that if there are clearly higher rates of depression and suicide and other mental problems among homosexuals, that must be a result of the pressures that society puts on them because of the hostility of society to homosexuality. The problem is that if you go to fairly gay-friendly countries like Sweden and the Netherlands, the evidence seems to suggest that homosexuals there still experience the higher rates of these difficulties. And I think that's not surprising, because I think that if we're right, that homosexuality is based on certain kinds of, you know, arrested development, you know, a failure for people to develop their sexual identity in the ordinary way, then we wouldn't be surprised that, in fact, there are a lot of unresolved issues there that could be a cause of a lot of these problems. And there's no question that, you know, many homosexuals do face, you know, very bad treatment in society, and I think, you know, that's been very unfortunate, and I think there's progress made there that we don't see the kind of, you know, literal gay bashing that we once saw. But the problem is that to say that we shouldn't go around beating up homosexuals or calling them queers or faggots or things of that sort doesn't mean that we should say necessarily that homosexual acts are good. That, you know, we can be, you know, tolerant of these people as individuals and treat them with charity, while at the same time recognizing that the kind of sexual activity they stand for is really inconsistent with the kind of healthy family life we want to see in society.
The vice president's argument, especially given the fact, the context that he has a daughter who is a lesbian, has the ring of compassion to it. Would legitimating same-sex marriage be an act of compassion?
See, it seems to me that it has the ring of the enabler about it. You know, that a guilty parent who feels bad for his kid feels that, you know, the only way to show his love for her is to say, well, go ahead and act the way you want to act. But any parent knows that that's not necessarily the compassionate thing to do, that sometimes compassion for your child means, you know, I love you and I always will, but the way you're acting is wrong. And I think, you know, certainly if we had a child who was an alcoholic or involved in, you know, promiscuous sexual activity, you know, many of us would say, well, gee, you know, the thing to do is to say, of course we love you, but what you're doing is wrong, and this is not the best way to live. And frankly, I think that's what Cheney should be saying to his daughter. You know, I think he should love her a lot, you know, keep the ties with her close, but not at the cost of sacrificing very fundamental moral principles.
Why do the advocates of same-sex marriage, why do they push for same-sex marriage and its legalization?
Well, naturally, from their perspective, they disagree fundamentally with the idea that homosexual activity is immoral. You know, they've kind of accepted a modern view of sex that sees it as oriented toward pleasure and personal intimacy, and excluding children very often. And under those circumstances, it seems to them that homosexual activity is perfectly legitimate. If that's the case, then for those people who do have these inclinations toward people of their own sex, it would be reasonable under those circumstances to say go ahead and engage in that activity. If once you accept the premise that, you know, we all are have our own particular inclinations, and as long as we don't harm people directly, we should be able to act on those inclinations, then it seems to follow that, you know, the consensual adult activity is okay. Now, there's still residual opposition to some aspects of that. For example, we don't accept polygamy or polyamory. You know, we still think that marriage is something that should be confined to one man and one woman. And just as Americans feel that way about polygamy, they feel that way about heterosexual marriage as well. They think that the fact that it's one man and one woman is really essential to the nature of the institution. But unfortunately, you know, especially among young people, that sense is weakening, and that's why we really have to, I think, go much deeper in our own understanding of marriage, those of us who believe in traditional marriage, and learn to articulate the purpose behind it well, intelligently, effectively, in order to try to educate people in society. And in fact, this whole debate over gay marriage is a great opportunity to do that. The problem is, as I suggested earlier, that a lot of people whose gut instincts are sound are in a way fatally compromised by their commitment to various kinds of heterosexual activities, which makes it very difficult to say no to homosexual activity as well.
Dr. Christopher Wolf is professor of political science at Marquette University, president of the American Public Philosophy Institute, editor of the books Homosexuality and American Public Life and Same-Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality. You can find out more about these two books. They contain a long series of essays on this subject. You can find out more about these books on the web at www.spencepublishing.com, spencepublishing.com, or you can call Spence Publishing toll-free at 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPEN-PUB. The books are titled Same-Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality and Homosexuality and American Public Life. 1-888-SPEN-PUB or SpencePublishing.com. Dr. Wolf, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
It's great to be here, Todd. I just want to remind your listeners that they can get a 50% discount by calling that number and mentioning your show.
1-888-SPEN-PUB is the number. Dr. Christopher Wolf. When we come back from this break, we are going to be talking with Mike Pierce, trying to explain the question that has been in the air and sometimes in the headlines and on the front of the news magazines for 3 years. Why? And I'm sure it's been on the mind of many even before that. Why? Why does the world seem to hate us? Not just Americans, but the Western world. Is there some fundamental disjunction between the way Westerners think and the way the rest of the world thinks? Is it just Islam? Or does it also have something to do with the difference between the West and the world? When we come back, we'll be talking with Mike Pierce about that.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does prayer bring God to me? Is prayer a pipeline of communication between a believer and God? And is that pipeline a two-way street? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is God Listening? Costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Does God decide how to answer requests based on how many people are praying? Find out with the book Is God Listening by Dr. Andrew Steinman. When you order, tell them, I listen to Issues, Etc., and I want the book of the month for August. The title is God Listening? Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Reading is a gift. This Global Minute lets you hear about people who are amazed to hear God's Word being read aloud to them. The story takes place in the African country of Senegal. A missionary was sitting under a mango tree in his front yard when a friend from the village stopped to visit and asked him to read aloud. Chad, the missionary who serves with the agency Mission Moving Mountains, read a portion of Romans 13. His friend was so excited that he gathered other men around, and they wanted to hear God's word being read out loud. Now they all meet for a weekly Bible study. Pray God will cause some of the men to act in what they hear so they give their lives completely to Christ. Also, pray they'll start learning how to read themselves. Enlarge your worldview with updated prayer requests and information from the website missionvisionnetwork.org. It's a resource for you and your church. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. She slips off every morning to do it. Diane and I usually sit together in the morning to read the papers over coffee, but sooner or later she slips away to indulge her habit. In the evening, she sneaks off to do it again. At first, a few hits made her feel good, but the habit is insatiable. A few hits are no longer enough. She wants more and more and more every day. My wife is a blogger. A blog is an online diary of sorts where the blogger comments on whatever. When Diane wrote about the Iraqi soccer team, all sorts of people, Iraqis included, visited her blog. And when she commented about sportscaster Bob Costas's political remarks, she got more hits. Blogs are becoming big-time media. Sinful human nature likes to complain, and a constantly heard complaint is the bias of traditional media outlets. The Spirit of Christ offers future heavenly blessings, but also motivates us to contribute here and now to society, not complain. Are most of us sitting in our easy chairs complaining about media? Or moving our mouse to get informed? Diane goes off to her blog, Res Publica, and comes back to tell me about the hits. I'm learning things not on TV. What a great time to be an involved citizen.
The AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week is Ascension Lutheran Church at the corner of Donovan and Eichelberger in St. Louis. Ascension is a proud sponsor of Word of Life Lutheran School, serving children from preschool through eighth grade. Ascension will celebrate the ministry of retiring principal Mr. Charles Conover during a special worship service beginning at 11 a.m. on Sunday, September 19th. For more information, call the Ascension Church office at 314-832-5600.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to conclude our series with the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August called God, Is God Listening? Dr. Andrew Steinman will join us tomorrow to conclude that series on Christian prayer. We're going to be talking about prayer as praise and what true praise is. Here's a little hint, folks. It's not how you feel, and it's not something you work up in yourself. It has far more to do with what God has done for you. It sounds counterintuitive, but we'll find out more about it. Tomorrow, he'll also give us some very helpful hints on making prayer a part of your life. That's Dr. Andrew Steinman tomorrow on the program, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for August. For the next 25 minutes of the program, to round off this first hour, Mike Pierce joins us. He's an historian, a lecturer in church history in Britain and the Balkans, and author of a new book, Why the Rest Hates the West. We're going to be talking about hostility toward Western civilization. Feel free to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Mike Pierce, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
First of all, let's just answer, if you would, yourself, your own question. Why does the rest hate the West?
I'm arguing in my book that many of the points that are frequently made to describe the various conflicts that the West is getting itself into miss the underlying causes. I'm not into the business, mainly because I'm not equipped, of analyzing the pros and cons of, say, the conflict in Iraq or Afghanistan, but looking at the wider historical causes. And I want to suggest that most non-Westerners feel intolerably threatened by us and Western culture, which I argue is perceived as an anti-culture, and the way it is encroaching upon the non-West as we aggressively export it. And that underlying disease is the background which enables people who lie at the far end of the spectrum of opinion, the terrorists, to act and to have at least understanding, even from those who would not actively support them.
Let's define Western culture or Western civilization. In what terms do you define it?
I'm picking up my book from the point where Samuel Huntington leaves the discussion off in his famous and best-selling book of the mid-1990s, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. His book has dominated a lot of discussion about geopolitics in the 10 years since, and quite rightly so. It's a masterpiece. I happen to think that he is right in most of his analysis, and I'm attempting to move the discussion on from there. He defines the West as being those cultures which are rooted historically in Europe and which have then spread through historical processes we're all well aware of to North America, to Latin America, and to parts of Australasia, Australia, New Zealand, and so on.
You credit Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation with making a major shift that was later undone in Western civilization, but they made a shift that had a lot to do with human nature, a proper understanding of human nature. What was that shift?
Yes, I want to argue that Luther and the Reformation signaled an advance on the traditional way in which morality had been discussed by highlighting interiority. That is, almost all human cultures, including the Catholic Middle Ages, had taught that salvation of whatever kind that was taught in that faith was to be achieved on the basis of good acts that were performed and bad acts that were avoided. And Luther pointed out that that's only the beginning of what I call the moral calculus, because as we look inside ourselves, we see that our motives, even for our very best actions, are very mixed, to say the least. And, of course, many of your readers will be familiar with some of, at least, of his biography. Perhaps no one in history tried harder to save his soul, and he concluded that despite it all, he was damned. And that insight and the need for faith in Christ is what triggered his step towards justification by faith, which was the mainstay of the Reformation. Now, I want to argue that although most people in Protestant Europe didn't have any kind of personal conversion experience, and so to that extent, the reformers weren't as successful as they wanted, what did happen was the highlighting of interiority and the importance of integrity, the common or garden understanding of ordinary people, that your inner motives ought to at least begin to match up to your outward behavior, and that was a substantial moral advance, which helped to create, amongst many other things, the conditions for the rise of industry and trade and capitalism, because it meant that you could trust the people you were doing business with, and helped the West towards its global hegemony, which it had achieved, well, certainly by the 19th century, really. And I'm arguing that what's happened over the past two or three generations is that we have moved away from all that, not backwards, but forwards. That is, that the whole interiority thing has taken on a life of its own and moved towards complete introspection, that our integrity now no longer means the conformity of your inward soul or my inward soul with the outward teachings of morality, but simply the conformity of your inward and outward behavior. So that even if you reject morality, for example, as long as you make no pretense to do otherwise, then you count as a person of integrity. And that kind of person is more and more and more frequently met with within Western societies.
So as long as, say, to our modern way of thinking, this redefinition of integrity, moving away from Luther's and the Reformers' model, as long as I never claim to be a truthful man, if I am, if my outward actions conform with my inner convictions, that it's okay to lie. I think it's okay to lie. I never claimed to be a truthful man. I'm considered to have some kind of integrity.
Yeah, well, bizarrely, in the postmodern West, that's the case. Whereas the shift initiated by Luther and the Reformers actually gave Westerners some kind of moral advance over traditional society, the taking the thing, the decisive and fatal step or two steps further, actually puts us well behind, morally speaking, traditional society. And Westerners don't appreciate how they are despised, and I mean morally despised, by non-Westerners.
Let's talk about the idea of human rights. Very briefly, trace its origin, and what role does it play in this thing called Western culture and civilization? We tend to think, Mike, that this is a war about human rights, the war with terrorism, the hatred of others for the West, that really it's a disjunction over the idea of human rights. Is this true?
Well, I fear that in part it is. Insofar as it really is a war against terrorism, then clearly we, as Westerners, can feel good about ourselves and say, well, we're on the side of the angels. But insofar as it's a war about human rights, it may well be that this should give cause for Western Christians to feel real unease. Maybe we're on the wrong side here. I argue, well, it hardly needs arguing, really, just state, point out the historic fact that human rights is an idea that begins with the 18th century Enlightenment. It has no real history before that. That's not to say that people never spoke in terms of rights before the 18th century. They certainly did, but they didn't mean anything like what we mean. They meant, it was not certainly 95% of the time, it was a reference to some empirical moral law. You can find rights mentioned in the Bible. For example, the rights of the poor are talked about in the Old Testament. But it's a reference to the Code of Moses, a particular legal code, not some abstract, free-floating idea. Abstract, free-floating ideas were restricted to duties, obligations, and that's the way that all people talked down to recent times, and of course outside of the West, still do. We don't talk about duties anymore. We allowed rights to become the free-floating abstraction from the 18th century onwards. And at first, it did give us some advantages, because the human rights idea, even though I want to suggest that it's bogus, was nevertheless employed in some pretty good causes, arguing, for example, that everybody ought to have a vote, or that there should be freedom of speech or religion and so on. But as we've moved on, it's come down to infect, for example, personal morality. Now, even amongst Christians in Western countries, almost all moral questions or political or social questions are discussed on the basis of rights. And I want to argue that this is fatal. It turns us into petulant egotists who demand things for ourselves. One of my cute little sentences in the book is that the sentence from Westerners beginning, "I have a right to," is almost always, "I want," dressed up in a tuxedo and palming itself off as a moral claim. But that's not really too much of an exaggeration. As a good for instance, I examine the debate over abortion, for example, and point out that as long as the debate is framed in terms of rights, the right of the child to life, the right of the mother to do what she wants with her body, politically there's only one winner, and it's the one that we see around us, the decision that we see around us. But if we reject this way of talking about morality and ask, in this circumstance, the pregnancy that is undesired for whatever reason, good or bad, who has a duty to whom? Again, we come up with only one possible answer, and it's the opposite one that our society comes up with.
So when non-Westerners hear Americans, both in our popular culture or in our public pronouncements as governments,
yes,
talk so much about rights and so little, if any at all, about duty and obligation, what do they hear?
They hear that we want to dissolve the solid categories of society that make life possible at all in anything other than the hyper-prosperity enjoyed by Westerners. I argue that we can only afford to talk the way that we do. We can only afford to live the way that we do in rejecting traditional morality and religion and constraint and respect and honor and duty and chastity. We can only afford all of those things because we can fall back on the safety net of our enormous wealth. And that people who enjoy anything less than that cannot possibly afford to do so. People who don't enjoy that depend upon their families and therefore upon very solid family structures for the essentials of life. And that requires them to fulfill all kinds of duties to named, identifiable individuals within those family structures, usually wider than just the nuclear family, actually. And that to move away from that would be insanity for them. And the fact that we, in the name of rights, are urging individual freedoms to do exactly what we please is perceived quite understandably, and I would argue rightly, as extremely dangerous and threatening.
So to just use one example, the dismantling of the notion of family, we can only do that in the West, you say, because we can afford, literally, we can afford to do without the traditional family. And that's not just a good thing. We can afford it monetarily.
Yes.
In the rest of the world, they can't afford it.
Yes. I mean, I right now, and almost anybody, presumably listening to this program, could conceivably walk away from their nuclear family. I could walk away from my wife and kids and go to another city 100 miles away or 1,000 miles away and reinvent my life. The first few years would be very tough. I would no doubt be required to pay alimony or whatever and maintenance for the kids. But it would be all right, and 5 years from now, certainly, and possibly a lot less than that, I would have surfaced, even financially and socially, a lot sooner than that. Now, that is unthinkable in any kind of society except ours. And indeed, even to walk away from one's parents or brothers or sisters or cousins would be extremely difficult because you need them as a network to back up, to give you the contacts, the assistance of all kinds that you will need in your daily life.
So the non-Westerner hears Western talk about rights as an argument against the community, against the family, and as basically just an argument for radical individualism.
Exactly so, and thereby the dissolution of all of the solid social structures that make human life bearable or even possible in an economy that is any weaker than super prosperous contemporary Western economies.
Let's talk about Western civilization, and in particular, I think a focus here mostly upon the American version of it, wherein we used to think of ourselves as standing on the shoulders of our ancestors, politically, theologically, culturally, morally.
Yes.
The modern American mindset is we're just standing up there in midair. We climbed up here by ourselves, and history is irrelevant. Or what's relevant is only that little patch of history that included us or our immediate circumstances.
Yeah, that's about right. Now, I don't simply want to adopt some kind of high horse as an academic and a historian, which would be very easy to do in this circumstance and say, and of course, we're the first people to do this, because that's not actually true quite. Most people, other than Westerners, took a far more respectful view of their ancestors and tradition than we do. That much is true, but they didn't necessarily know an awful lot more about it. It doesn't entitle me as a teacher of history to go around grumbling how little the ordinary person knows about the past, because people in the past didn't know too much about the past either. But they nevertheless attempted to perpetuate the ways of their ancestors into the future. We have no sense of that. Up until the 18th century, the idea was that the world was, if anything, declining, and that we had a duty to pass on what we'd received from posterity into the future as well as we could. But the 18th century turned that around and brought in what we call the progress myth, that if anything, the past was a series of bad mistakes which we were best off being liberated from. Now, the 20th century has kind of tested that idea to destruction, although it still persists in some parts of the West, I guess. But nevertheless, we haven't gone back to the previous idea of following tradition. If anything, we've simply moved on to say, well, the course of history is pretty meaningless. You know, it could go any direction, so the best we can do is have one heck of a good time now.
You take on the issue of what you call Western common sense. What do you mean by that, and what's the problem?
Well, what I would call common sense in any culture is those ideas which are so deeply embedded within it that everybody around you takes the idea in question as axiomatic, and therefore to question it seems a little strange, but of course that's precisely what I am doing, and saying that there are certain ideas in the West, which we receive as common sense, which ain't necessarily so. And as a historian, looking at where those came from. So there's a whole series of those ideas, some of them relating to our political life. The idea, for example, of a nation state, that's a very recent idea indeed, past couple of centuries. Human rights, we've had a look at that, and so on.
We're talking with Mike Pierce. He's an historian, a lecturer in church history in Britain and the Balkans, and author of the new book, Why the Rest Hates the West. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be joined by Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. We'll get a live update on the Republican National Convention being held this week in New York. Mike, the culture that we export, the West exports to the world, how do non-Westerners see that culture? In what primary terms or hues do they perceive that culture?
Well, I have, the way I put it pretty early on in my book is, and of course this is a vast generalization, we're talking about the attitudes of a variety of widely differing hundreds of millions of people here, but if we can boil that down somewhat, we're perceived, I've said, as rich, technologically sophisticated, economically and politically dominant, morally contemptible barbarians. I argue that that's a hateful combination of feelings and assessments in the sense that the one who makes them will as often as not be filled with hatred for the objects of such contemplation. And then, why barbarians? Well, for despising tradition, the ancestors, and the dead. Now, most of your listeners will already have picked up that in that sentence there I'm using slightly strange language, and its strangeness to us is an indication of how different we are to all of the other people who've ever lived and outside of the West still do live. For despising religion, or at least for treating it lightly, for the shallowness and triviality of their culture, for their sexual shamelessness. We're not the first society to be sexually promiscuous, though it's unusual, the degree to which we've taken it, but all of your readers will be able to think of Corinth in the first century, but the way that we've elevated that to the point of principle, for their loose adherence to family and sometimes also to tribe, and for their absence of any sense of honor. And usually when I'm teaching about this or taking classes, the whole idea of honor actually requires some explanation to many people in that group, and that again is an indication of how far we've traveled from the way that the vast majority of humanity has thought and continues to think.
You also talk in the book about the infantilized church, or I want to focus on this whole concept of Western culture being mired in adolescence.
Yes.
You say that the adolescent in Western culture lives in a paradise, at least materially, but I'm wondering about the whole concept of adolescence, this kind of dream world between childhood and adult duty, where people get to extend it all the way up into their 30s, their 40s, and perhaps even into retirement.
Yes. Well, to focus on what perhaps until recently, more traditionally, we would have called adolescence, the shift from childhood to adulthood is far more problematic for us than for anybody else. And it gives rise to all manner of phobias, fears, addictions, afflictions, and distresses, which anybody who's been involved in any kind of pastoral work will be all too familiar with. It's problematic. It's bound to be problematic in a sense because of the age at which hormones kick in, although because we are so well-fed and healthy, they kick in earlier with us than they do with normal human beings. And that's really too bad because real entry into the adult world is delayed for us by many, many more years than was the case with previous societies. Almost everyone will continue their schooling until at least 18 and via university, generally until their early, sometimes mid-20s. So they won't have adult responsibilities placed upon them. Now, anybody who's familiar with human behavior at all will realize that having adult responsibilities acts as a wonderful social compliance mechanism in making us far more dutiful and responsible in terms of the way that we behave and the attitudes that we have. And we're extending that period. So the sexual hormones kick in around 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and actual real entry into adult life doesn't really get going until around the mid-20s. We're creating a problem for ourselves. And the second thing is this. In traditional societies, it was always obvious and had been from as soon as the young child was conscious at all that the trajectory their life was following was to be their father's son or their mother's daughter. And there was never any doubt about who they were. Our young people, and even very, very many millions of our younger adults, aren't at all sure who they are, because the ideal in our society is to create your own identity in distinction from your family, to show yourself as an individual, a loner. Now, that's exciting because it gives you unprecedented freedom, but it leaves you completely clueless as to who you really are. We can and do reinvent ourselves and reinvent our lives at different stages in our lives. That in some senses, that's liberating, but it's also extremely depressing because we don't really know who we are. And that hits our young people hardest.
Mike Pierce is our guest. We'll take a phone call here. Mike, would you be willing to stay with us for a few minutes on the other side of this break? Let's talk with Bill in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Listens on the Internet. Bill, very quickly, a question before we go to this break for Mike.
Yes. I came in late on this conversation, so I hope I'm not asking something horribly off the wall. You were talking about tradition. And I'm wondering what significance or what weight the likes of hermeneutical philosophy, as we see in Gadamer, and the importance of tradition and the historical consciousness, whether that has found its way into our consciousness in the 21st century.
Bill, thank you very much for the call. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll get the response to Bill's question for Mike Pierce. Mike is an historian, a lecturer in church history in Britain and the Balkans, and author of the new book, Why the Rest Hates the West. We're talking about the hostility of the world, in some cases, toward Western civilization. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A few more minutes with Mike Pierce on the other side of this break, and then in the second hour, Congressman John Shimkus will be our guest of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. He will give us a live update of this week's Republican National Convention in New York, just underway officially today, although the protests have been bubbling there in the Big Apple for some time. Then, in the third hour of the program, we will hear the preaching. You're going to want to listen for this, folks. You're going to stay tuned for this. Of Juanita Bynum. Her weapons of power, and she's going to be talking about the phrase from the Lord's Prayer, Thy will be done. We'll evaluate that preaching in the third hour of Issues, etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.